This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Not going to have a heavy shiur, not part of the usual series. What I want to do is wrap up the sukkah series. As I mentioned on Monday night, there's a section of the sukkah series that applies to women particularly. We've spoken about the two mitzvahs of sukkahs, the sukkah and the lulav, and how the sukkah is a mitzvah that costs nothing because you don't have to have your own sukkah. The fact is we're all sitting in Esther sukkah, we've paid nothing, we've contributed nothing towards it, milt sukkah, and we're eating their food. And we're getting the same mitzvah that milt is getting, sitting in his own sukkah. There's no linkage between financial investment in the mitzvah and the performance of the mitzvah and the reward for the mitzvah, and there's no linkage to effort and reward in this mitzvah. There's no effort involved. We're going to eat in any case, we're going to have meals in any event, so all we have to do is have the meal in the sukkah, and the sukkah is meant to be comfortable. As we discussed on Monday night, if the sukkah becomes uncomfortable, you're not supposed to sit in it. So there is no discomfort associated with the mitzvah of sukkah. There's no investment of energy, there's no investment of money. The mitzvah of lulav is exactly the opposite. The mitzvah of lulav, there is an investment of money, it's expensive, there's investment of energy. If you do the mitzvah properly every morning, it's actually quite demanding in terms of movement. And there's no benefit. You get no material, no physical benefit at all. And the relationship between these two mitzvahs we've discussed in terms of learning to properly synthesize the need to possess and the need to be, to experience. And we talked about how the West and Western religion has focused generally on having, on possession, and on building status and power through possession. It's not really possible for a person in the United States to have status if he doesn't possess a lot. He has to possess something. He has to possess, and the more he possesses, the more status he's got, almost irrespective of what kind of person he is. Whereas there are some societies, if you go into some Far Eastern societies, possession is irrelevant. You can, some of the greatest people, Gandhi and these people, had no possessions. And they were considered people of enormous status, people very great and very exceptional, and they occupied status and they had power. So power in the East was not related to possession, and power in the West is related to possession. And we talked about how neither of those are really true, because to impact, the Jew uses possession. And yet, having possession doesn't say anything about him. Person without a soul can have possession. So the soul grows from its being, from the existential activities that it engages in, and the ability to impact grows from possessions. But there is an overlap, and that is that the soul can also become a possession. One can master one's soul and use that as an implement of impact, and we develop that idea. And similarly, one can use possession to expand one's soul. A person who has possession, a person who has substance, can use that in the development of his soul as well. And they should not be compartmentalized. That's really the mitzvah of sukkah. But in sukkah there needs to be the combination of both, and we express the combination of both in the mitzvah of ushpizin and chesed. The ushpizin are guests with whom we can only impact spiritually, and they demand that we have physical guests with whom we can impact materially, but they demand of us to impact on our physical guests spiritually too. And that's the point of merging, that there's got to be a physical engagement with spiritual substance. If there's only spiritual substance, there's no engagement. If there's only engagement, there's no spirituality, there's no soul. What sukkah is about, what sukkot is about, the chag of sukkot with the different mitzvahs, is bringing together these two poles of impact through possession and growth through being, and creating impactful growth through possession and being, which is uniquely Jewish. So So after one of those shiurim, Mr. Lipman said to me, if it's so important and so beautiful, why are women not included in that mitzvah? It seems to be something essential to the growth of the human being. And although women have reward for sitting in a sukkah or for using a little of an esrog, they're not obligated to do so. And why should that be? So I said to Mr. Lipman, that's a very good subject for the ladies' shiur. And that bought me a bit of time. Then I got to the office and Desi said to me, if it's such an important mitzvah, why are men and women, why are women not supposed to be chayiv in that mitzvah? So I said, well, that's okay for the ladies' shiur. So she said, no, but it's bothering me now. I can't work properly unless you explain it to me. So I couldn't fob her off with the ladies' shiur. So I said, well, because women are naturally synthesized in this area. She said, you can pull that over their eyes at PJC, but that's placating. That's not real. That's not the truth. There must be something more truthful than that. That's not the truth. So what we've got to deal with today is the truth. Why are women not obligated to do the mitzvah of lulav and sukkah if the mitzvah of lulav and sukkah is really the essence of human growth? And the answer is very disturbing and politically incorrect. So I tried it out on Desi. I thought if she accepts it, then probably anybody will. So I think that was about, you said you don't like it, but it's true. So that's all right. I think it's worth it. I can risk it on everybody else. And it's really things we've dealt with previously already. It's nothing new. It's a matter of just pulling it all together. The way I want to treat this is first by working it out from the Torah, what the answer is. And then discussing whether you agree with the Torah. You don't have to agree with the Torah. One is free to disagree with the Torah. It's not a wise thing to do. It's not very bright to disagree with the Torah, but one is free to do so. And then how it applies today. Whether there have been any changes in that area. The mitzvah of the By the way, the fact that a woman is potter from the mitzvah of sukkah is complicated in as much as if she's married, she's not really potter, or if she has children, she's not really free from that mitzvah. Because the din is that you've got to live in the sukkah the way you do in your house. And if you live in your house with your family, then you live in your sukkah with your family. So she can't really say, I'm not chayav. Because if she does that, then he's not being mechayim the mitzvah. So we've got a strange thing with mitzvah sukkah. The only mitzvah I can think of, that although the woman is not obligated, if she doesn't perform it, it detracts from his mitzvah. So he actually needs her presence to make that mitzvah worthwhile for him. Otherwise, there's a flaw in his mitzvah. So you very often hear people saying, if the sukkah is full of something, then the woman says, don't worry, we'll sit inside. And the men sit outside. That's a problem. If that's not the way you normally do it, if you're from the kind of community where the women sit in the kitchen for meals generally, then they don't have to sit in the sukkah. There's no problem with that. But if you're from the kind of community where women join their families at the table, then there's a problem with women not being present in the sukkah. Not for them, but for the man it's no mitzvah. Very strange mitzvah. I can't think of another mitzvah that a woman has to do, although she's not obligated, because if she doesn't, he hasn't got the mitzvah. She has the power of his mitzvah in her hand. She can actually decide whether he's fulfilled the mitzvah properly or not, by whether she chooses to do something she doesn't have to do. And that's an important element of the model that we need to discuss. Liz, good morning, good morning. I can't believe we didn't keep a seat for you. We must have known you were still coming. How did we not keep a seat for you? What other one can you think of? I think you're right. I think there's a comparison. It's not exactly the same, but I think there is a comparison that although the primary obligation to have children is the man's, he cannot do it without a woman. So he's got to persuade her. He's got to make it worthwhile for her. He's got to make it something she enjoys and wants to do too. She has a natural desire to do that, but there is a similarity. I think you're right.
What about
I think there's a connection.
The mikvah be similar?
The mikvah she's obligated to do. No, she's obligated to go to the mikvah if they live together. That's her mitzvah. She gets the mitzvah. It's not his mitzvah. It's her mitzvah. But sukkah is not her mitzvah, and yet, unless she does it, he can't fulfill it properly either. And that's an important dimension for this model. Now, that's as far as the sukkah is concerned. Of course, for lulav, she doesn't have to at all. If she wants to use the lulav, that's fine. She doesn't have to use the lulav, and whether or not she uses the lulav in no way impacts on his mitzvah, the lulav. In the mitzvah of lulav, as we mentioned in shul on the first day, it introduces the mitzvah by saying, ulekachtem lochem beyom harishon, which literally means you shall take for yourselves on the first day, and halachically means you shall acquire for yourselves, you shall purchase, you shall invest in a lulav and esrog on the first day, and everything that goes with a lulav and esrog. Usamachtem lifnei Hashem elokechem shivas yomim, and you shall rejoice before God for 7 days. Now this word ulekachtem we find in Bereishis. And we find it in a number of places, but in this particular context, we find it when Abraham wants to buy the Maras HaMachpelah from Ephron. Ephron says, "You don't have to buy it. You can." Have it for nothing, and Avram said out of the question, and they have a whole discussion about it. So he wants to bury sorrow there, and Ephraim says, well, it'll be our honor, and he says, no, he wants to purchase it. And eventually he says, Vayedaber el Ephron boznei amhoritz leimor, Avraham spoke to Ephron in the presence of the people of the land, saying, Ach imata lu shema'ini, please listen to me. Nosati kesef hasodeh, I have provided the money for the field. Kach mimeni, take it from me. Ve'ekbero es meisi shoma, so that I may bury my departed one there. So kach b'meni, that same word of take the money, again in relationship to money, we have the word kach in the purchase of a field. The third place where we have it in relationship to money is in Dvorim. Where the Torah says the following, Ki yikach ish isho. If a man should marry a woman, but the word used here is yikach, take, or acquire. And the Gemara learns from this that just as the field was acquired with money, he said, here I've provided the money, take it, so a woman can be acquired with money. And we've discussed this before. But that's one of the three means of performing a kinyan, of concluding the marriage ceremonies with money. And when we give a ring under the chuppah, that's what we're doing. It's currency. We're buying. And it's interesting that which is considered universally so romantic, and at the moment of placing the ring on the bride, all it is money. And the ring could just as well be dollar, not dollar notes, but dollar coins. You want to take a silver, they have silver dollars, don't they? You want to take a silver dollar, in fact, if you wanted to take a dime, you could do it with a dime as well. That's how much romance there is in it. There's nothing romantic about it at all. It's a financial transaction. That's what takes place under the chuppah. And you don't need the chuppah for that. The chuppah is for the sheva brachas. All you need is two witnesses. So you can take a woman and two witnesses, give her a dime and say, you're mine, do you agree? And she says, yes, she's married. That's it, wedding done. So that's what a wedding. That's what a Jewish wedding is. What a Jewish wedding is. When people say, "I love a Jewish wedding," what they really mean is, "I love a Greek wedding," because that's what they're really referring to is the dancing and all that. Which is the same with a Greek wedding. There's nothing Jewish about that. A Jewish wedding is a financial transaction. A man takes money out of his pocket and gives it to his wife. And she agrees, and that's a Jewish wedding. Then she's married. Everything else is just decoration. And we discussed that, and I'm going to come back into it, and it appears to be demeaning. And we discussed the fact that Masechta Kiddushin, that the tractate that deals with marriage is called Kiddushin. What a beautiful name. Kiddushin, sanctification. And that's what we call a marriage, sanctification. And what is the act of Kiddushin, the act of sanctification? Is giving the lady a dime. Or a gold ring. It doesn't make any difference what it is, as long as it has a value of how much? A pruta. And a pruta is how much?
That's the cost of a Kleenex. Because it's a joke. Used! But he hates me to bring that up.
Yeah, I don't know about the cost of a Kleenex, but certainly the cost of the cheapest thing you could buy. I don't know if you can still buy anything with a cent, with a penny, but if you can, that's what it would be. Or 2 pennies. I don't know what the cheapest. Farthing in the old days. I don't know but that's basically what a pruta is. That's all it has to be. That is a Jewish wedding. What does it mean and why is it? And that's outside. Ha'isha, niknes, b'sholosh drachim. You can acquire women with three ways. The one is kesef, money, a legal contract, or sex. That's the introduction to Masechta Kiddushin, the tractate of sanctity, of the sanctity of marriage. That's how it opens. And that's all learnt out from this word yikach, the same word that is used by the lulav. And the word lokach, the reason that this is relevant, that word is relevant, is that there's a difference between lokach and mekabel. Mekabel means receive and lokach means take. What's the difference between lokach and mekabel? What's the difference between receiving and taking?
Taking seems less mannerly. Receiving is like someone gives it to you, you're receiving it. Taking, you think that you're sort of grabbing. I don't know.
Well, you're only grabbing if it isn't yours. Yes, one needs a giver. Okay, you receive from somebody you have given. You take without a giver. So why is there no giver in the taking? Because you can only take something which is yours. You can receive something which isn't yours. You can receive a gift. That you can only take something which is yours. If you're taking something which is not yours, it's theft. It's a different word. It's called goinev. Lokeach means you're taking something which is yours, which means you've already paid for it. So when the Torah uses the word lokeach, it implies a two-way transaction. So for example, Avram says, here's the money, take it from me, it means I've got your field already, you've given me the field, so the money is yours. Take it. Just take it. And I'm not receive it, I'm not giving it to you, it's yours, take it, put it in your pocket, it's yours.
How
does the field take? Because Ephron already said, he has the field, I don't want it, he said, the field is yours. So Avraham says, the field is mine, then the money is yours, because I'm not doing it for nothing. Take the money, it's yours already, I've got the field.
So the receiving is the first part.
It depends what kind of receiving. It depends what the conditions of the receiving are. So when you say, for example, ki yikach ish isho, a man takes his wife. What does that mean? He's already bought her, right? He's given her the money. She's accepted the money so that he can yikach ish isho. Now he can take his wife. Taking his wife means taking that which already belongs to him. So when the Torah uses the word lokach, it implies a transaction, and it implies ownership. Implies that it's not a transaction of generosity, it's a transaction of equality. Not that the Kleenex and the women are equal in value, but in equality in the sense of something has been given in return. It is not a one-way transaction, it's a two-way transaction. That's what the word lokach means. And since the Torah uses the word lokach in the case of the field transaction and the case of the woman transaction, the Gemara learns out that money is one of the valid ways of acquiring a woman. And I think we went into that in some detail at one point, didn't we? Why material generosity is an important, not only an important, but is the initiation and subsequent sustenance. And all three of them are, I think we discussed, the sustenance of the relationship. The money, material generosity, is a prerequisite and is an ongoing requisite. the legal contract represents communication, the ability to communicate ideas and to deal with issues and problems in a communicative way, and the physical relationship. When those three aren't healthy, the marriage is in trouble. Not when two of them aren't healthy or one of them isn't healthy. When those three aren't healthy, the marriage has a problem. Those three need to be ongoing things, and we discussed why that is. So when the Gemara says that a woman is acquired with those three things, that acquisition, as Rav Shimon Shkop explains, continues throughout the marriage. It doesn't, it's not only under the chuppah. It's initiated under the chuppah, but that acquisition goes on over and over and over again. Now, that being the case, a woman, the Maharal Mipraig points out that a woman in the Ten Commandments is classified in an interesting place. What does it say about a woman? You shall not covet a man's house and his donkey and his motor car and his wife and his this and his that and his that. That's where she's classified, says the Maharal. So she's classified as part of his possession. When we talk about the possessiveness, the possessive element of life and the growth through possession, part of a man's growth is through the wife he possesses. Now that in primitive society is understood very well. We're going to have to deal with it in modern society. And that's why it was interesting. We were doing some work, Desi and I, in a company in South Africa with where there were a lot of black people, and our issue was women in the workplace, and the black men could not understand, relate, or accept the principles of sexual harassment. And by them, sexual harassment is not saying, like in the United States, saying good morning to a lady. That's not what they meant by sexual harassment. They meant anything. And they could not accept that there was anything wrong with it. They could not understand, and they felt culturally limited. They felt culturally invaded by any sense that sexual harassment should not be okay. Now, it was not okay with the women, but it was okay with the men. And that's an interesting discussion, that there's an element of possession. This is an object, and I can do with my objects as I please, and I can exchange objects and acquire objects and do what I want.
Even if it's not his object?
Yes, as long as it's not someone else's. If she's an unmarried woman, free game, no problem at all.
Well, at some level.
At some level, true. At some level. Let's try and go a level deeper. So what are we saying? That ulekachtim lachem, we're saying that but essential to the mitzvah of sukkah is learning the integration of growth through acquisition with growth through being. And we're saying that the woman in her relationship to her husband has a relationship not of possessing, but of being possessed. And what we want to do is explore that relationship a little bit further, and explore the difference a little bit further. Is there something inherently different in this particular area between man and woman? We were at the Long Beach Aquarium yesterday, and one of the amazing things we learned there was that there are many fish that are where all the entire fish species is born female, like sea bass. They're all born female. No males are ever born. Through stress, they change. They become male. We had quite an interesting discussion. Yeah, my son's problem was, what can there be that can stress a fish?
What?
You know, you're sort of watching these fish, and they're saying, what can you imagine a stressful existence? So I explained, you know, introduce a shock, and one can imagine the stress.
Maybe the stress of a female not having children.
Whatever it is, but that was quite interesting, that they actually changed sex. And then we discussed it. Does that mean, and then my son-in-law said, but doesn't that happen with human beings as well? That as women go into business very often and they experience the stress, they change sex and they become men. Maybe humans also do that, and that affects a whole lot. Not physically, although it sometimes impacts on fertility. Very often those same women can't have children. When all of a sudden they want children and they want to act as women and they can't. And then they're at gynecologists and psychologists and all sorts of things, but they're men already at that stage. And it probably has some, I don't know if it's been measured, but I wouldn't be surprised if it has actually some hormonal impact on not just a behavioral one, but actually a physiological one. The world of possession is a male world. The world of growth through possession That means a woman grows through being more than through having, and she grows most of all through being had by a man who has everything. That would be her best. A man who needs nothing except her, she being the only possession that he hasn't got. Imagine how intoxicating that could be. A man who has power, who has money, who has it all, and he desperately wants you. That's all he wants. Remember, they even made a movie about that. That one with Robert Redford. What was it? Remember, and the husband agrees. Remember that? Remember that? I don't remember what it was called. That's right. That's right. That's right. The intoxication of that moment of a man who can possess whatever he wants. The one thing he doesn't have, you have. In fact, it is you. And a woman finds far more power in that situation than in the possession.
Some women.
We're talking about 100% women. We're talking about the woman model. Finds more power in that position, possession than in possessing. What we need to understand, though, is the difference between the woman as a possession and lulav and esrog and any other possession is that. That's right, in the beginning of the Torah. What are we saying? What is the purpose of possession? What did we say the purpose of possession was with the lulav and esrog? Impact. You can't impact without possession, nor can you even impact on yourself to some degree. There is a limit to how much impact you can have on yourself with only being. In the physical world, you need certain things even in order to be able to impact on yourself. What about the woman? What about the wife? Her function also is possession for the purpose of impact. It's not a purpose of trophy. It's not a question of something to display. It's of a man saying, I cannot achieve what I need to achieve without you. Just as if I'm in the transport business, I cannot do that if I do not have a fleet of the best trucks available. If I'm in the life business, I cannot engage successfully in the life business unless I possess a wife. Can't do it. Something missing. I need instruments. I need tools. I need to learn. I need to experience. I need to expand. And I cannot do that on my own. So when we're talking about possession, we're not talking about a possession that you lock up in a safe. We're talking about a possession that you put on your display cabinet. We're talking about a possession with whom you engage in order to facilitate that kind of growth. And the fact that the woman is the key to his growth, and again, we're not talking about a woman being a key to the growth of a shlemil, then she becomes a shlemil nurturer. We're talking about the woman being the key of growth to a man who has grown as far as he can without her and cannot go any further. Again, just like the material parallel of the man who has everything but except the woman that he loves, and that gives that sense of power. So the man who can achieve spiritually, has gone as far as he can and is going as far as he can, but cannot go further without an Ezer Kenegdo, that becomes the point at which he becomes an essential possession, something or someone to have exclusivity with, so as to be able to build the next level of spiritual achievement. And Desi says some women, and I argue all women, just manifests in different ways and comes out in different ways. All men want a woman. All healthy men want a woman. But by no means do all men want marriage. They need to be beguiled into marriage usually. All women want marriage. All healthy women want marriage. There's a difference. A woman, even if one reduces it to its most physical and intimate levels, even the words, the phrases a woman will use at times where she loses control over herself at moments of physical and intimate ecstasy, of things like take me, have me, possess me. There is something very deep down in the way God created a woman, that her security comes not from possessing but from being possessed. A man's security comes from conquest, from competing, from being able to expand his area of influence, and a woman's too. She also wants to expand her area of influence, but and a man can't do it on his own. A man to extend his area of influence needs a woman, and a woman to extend her area of influence needs a man. But what they need from one another is completely different. He needs to possess her, and she needs to be possessed by him in that relationship. That doesn't mean that's all she is. If a woman is fulfilled in her relationship with her husband, she has certain male aspects of herself in other areas of her life, in her children, in education, in her work, in her career, in her business, in her social life, in all sorts of other areas. But in that relationship, what he wants is the ability to possess, and what she wants is the ability to be possessed. And that's why inherently in the Torah, it's not recommended, nor is it really even tolerated. But certainly inherently, the laws of adultery are so severe on the woman and so less severe on the man. So a man can have more than one wife. Strictly speaking, he can marry more than one wife. A woman cannot marry more than one man. You can possess more than one, but you cannot be possessed by more than one. Then you have a partnership, and that's a problem. The relationship and what is needed in that relationship is inherently different. A man, there are problems in a man having more than one wife. The Torah makes that very clear, and it was never a lechatchila. If you look at all the early stages, they were all more than one wife because of problems. Avram didn't want more than one wife. Yitzchak didn't have more than one wife. Yaakov didn't want more than one wife. Moshe, and all our great people except the kings ideally wanted one wife. But the Torah in its model says having more than one wife does not destroy what a man wants from a woman. It's not good for family, but it doesn't destroy what a man wants from a woman. But having more than one husband destroys totally what a woman wants from a man. So there's no way that can exist in a polygamous marriage on the part of a woman. Therefore, the process of synthesis of Lulav and Esrog and Sukkah doesn't apply to a woman in that particular relationship. Let's just take it one step further, and that is, so what then is the woman's role? Because what we can actually touch on is one of the most destructive elements in a marriage and one of the most supportive elements in a marriage. Based on this discussion, what would you say is the most destructive element in a marriage? Just based on this discussion, there are lots of elements, but based on this discussion, what undermines the essence of a marriage? Competitiveness. Okay, the moment she starts competing, so we say, is the male ego so weak or not? Yes, it is. We've discussed that often. But this has got nothing to do with male ego. This has got to do with what people want from one another. Why they got together in the first place. So why did he get together with her?
To possess her,
which means we've got a job to do. I need your support to achieve that. If you identify with the job we've got to do, then support me in the achievement of that and we'll do it together. The moment she's competing, that relationship is undermined on both sides. She ceases to have what she wants. A competitor doesn't, you don't possess your competition. You either destroy your competition or you are destroyed by your competition. So once you, otherwise you're out of business and you can't, or you carry on competing. So once competitiveness gets into the relationship, there is self-destructiveness that is built in, because that's not what that relationship is about. We compete with everybody else. The one area that there shouldn't be competitiveness is in the marriage relationship. There shouldn't be any space for competitiveness. Which means either the woman shares the husband's vision and participates in it, or she doesn't care what his vision is. He's just so wonderful to her that whatever he does, he can be the mafia leader, and that's fine with her because she supports him no matter what he does. So she doesn't share the vision, but she shares in him. Or she could have a vision of her own. Here comes the whole question of the working of a career woman. Provided, now comes the big question, when the decision has to be made, is which one gets precedence? Mm-hmm. One job requires a transference to another city. So the modern thing is, well, let's figure out who's making more money, whose career is there, who's supporting. Well, okay, that's where we'll go. Very rational. But it's the beginning of the end of the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, the balance changes. At that point, what they got married for from a marriage, it's a nice partnership, and they might be very good friends, and it might be a relationship that works. But not for this. So what then is the outcome? So now you've got husband and wife. She's given an incredible opportunity. he's in a so-so job and he's quite transferable. They decide to emigrate or to change city or whatever it is for purposes of his career. Relationship is good. They respect each other. They love each other. Everything's fine. But the marriage is over at that point. Now what happens?
She's the boss, so I guess.
Well, in a kind of a... what? But what's the next step in that marriage? Guaranteed.
They'll start looking for other people.
Absolutely, he will. And maybe she too. He needs a support. He needs an Azo now. He's got a fantastic colleague that he can share ideas with and really great, but he doesn't have an Azo. Where's his Azo connector? So he'll look out. He'll search for it in other relationships. That's the Torah's model. Now I challenge you to tell me that it doesn't apply today. You might tell me that it's difficult today. You might tell me that in today's environment we have major problems with this model. That the way society is structured and operates is not very friendly to this model. And that creates all sorts of pressures both at home and at work. And that, yes, and that we can deal with. But is the Torah's model arguable? Can you argue on it?
I just want to clarify something and make sure I understand. The reason it's not working is because he's more dependent on her because her job is stronger.
Yeah, because he doesn't have an Azer anymore. He doesn't have a supporter. She's not there to support. They're now pursuing her career. So it's her vision that they're onto.
She's not dependent on him as a supporter.
She's not. Her life is not about supporting him. Her life is about pursuing her career, and their life is about pursuing her career. So in terms of his position, he doesn't possess her. There's no way he can possess her. And I guarantee that couple will very soon start having sexual problems. Very, very soon after they make that transfer. And even if he finds himself a good job there. Because that possession, his ability to possess her, is over. That's no longer a relationship of possession. It's a friendship. It might be a great... You see couples like that that have a very good relationship, but it's not a marriage.
That happens all the time in America.
I know. It's their fault.
Right.
And therefore, so does divorce happen all the time in America.
That's the reason for his lack of being able to keep his financially...
No, not necessarily. No, she's probably much brighter than him.
So what's
she's brighter and more dynamic. She should have married somebody else. That's a problem. She should have married somebody else, or he should have pulled up his socks and compete and become
big. The reason he didn't pull up his socks because the role his father's role model.
There can be all sorts of reasons. There can be all sorts of reasons. It's societal and it's the father and it's this and that. And there are two issues. The one is, does he have the capacity to match her? In which case he should develop that capacity, and if he does not have the capacity, he shouldn't be in that relationship in the first place. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, a very strange Mishnah, Al tarbe sicho im ha'isha, don't talk too much with the woman. Now that's understandable, as difficult as it is, but the next phrase is really not understandable. That, says the Mishnah, is talking about your wife. How much more so with other women? There are lots of questions on that Mishnah. One of the important questions is, how much is too much? Says, don't speak too much with a woman. Most things are told very specific. How much wine on Friday night, and how big the glass must be, and how big the matzah must be, and how big a mikveh must be, and how big a sukkah must be, and not too big and not too small, and so many walls. We're told, we're given measurements. Now the Torah comes with something so important that affects us every day of our lives. It says, don't speak too much. Don't have a sukkah that's too big. Don't eat a piece of matzah that's too small. How small? How big? What does it mean? So clearly the answer is there isn't a fixed measure. We're talking about proportions. And what is too much? Too much is that it drains you. Too much is that what the woman is able to engage in is something you can't provide. And it says, Be'ishtoy omru, that's with your own wife. Therefore, what are you supposed to do? What is the Mishnah advising you? To stop communicating with your wife. Watch out who you marry. Make sure that the person that you marry is somebody whose needs for communication you can satisfy. Because if you cannot, you're going to be in a relationship that isn't going to work. So that relationship, if she's a super achiever, she had better marry a super, super achiever. And if he's not yet a developed super, super achiever, then that's something that needs to develop real fast. And she needs to watch it while it's developing, that she doesn't always keep him down and outshine him, because then you're right. Then her superiority can impact on it.
Because when children are there, bills have to be paid. If the husband isn't producing, the woman has to develop.
Sure. From a commercial point of view, it makes excellent strength.
never knew she had.
Correct. And in so doing, she destroys the marriage.
And
she provides for her children and destroys her relationship with her husband. Correct. Correct. And I'm not suggesting that therefore a woman holds herself back, because if a man is performing because his wife is holding herself back, then unless he's stupid, he sees through it and realizes. It doesn't help that she's holding herself back. He's got to be performing, because in those areas that's what he does, but it must never become competition. It's got to become an expectation, but not a competition.
How does it fill in with the parallel kind of situation?
It doesn't.
So the learning is not more powerful than her working to support
if he's
them?
A powerful learner.
Right.
If he's a man who can change the world with his understanding of a sugya of Gomorrah, then my goodness, is that powerful. That's more than any business he could possibly own.
Yeah.
But if he's sitting around and draying and draying and draying, that's nothing.
So what happens if the woman is just more not just intelligent, but she's just more of a go-getter in the business world than he is? But she's attracted to him. She wants him.
He's got to find areas in which he's superior, or else what you sometimes find happens and works is a reversal of roles. What doesn't work is competition. So you can have a situation where he's the woman and she's the man, and that works.
He becomes feminine, she becomes supportive.
And if he's comfortable with that and she's comfortable with that, you've had a successful role reversal. Now, whether that's ideal or not, and how that works sexually, I'm not sure. But there are some women.
I don't think they can find me.
That's a problem. And there was a move. You'll be interesting. You asked about Kollel. There was a move in Israel about 30 years ago when Rabbi Kupferman started the Michlala, and Beis Yaakov was becoming intellectually. Beis Yaakov Seminary was becoming into when Rebbetzin Davidson took it over, and it started becoming intellectually sophisticated. There was a move to get them to tone it down, because these girls are outperforming their husbands. And they did not tone it down, and the result is that in many cases in the yeshiva world, the girls are outperforming the men. And they have a level of insight and understanding that the men, many of them, do not have. And is it causing marital problems? Yes, it is.
I even see that in the more conservative type of lifestyle, there are single women, especially when I was up on the Upper West Side of New York, that outshine the men by far, and they're not getting married because they outshine the men.
Yes.
I mean, what happens in this situation is the men just don't measure up, though.
We're living in the most interesting society of the decomposition of men.
Mm-hmm.
The last 30 years, and one can say it was women's libs that did it, and I say no, women's lib did it because the women were saying, really, come on, guys, you know, we want something more than this. Mm-hmm. And the guys were saying, well, you know, if you want to do it all, fine. Do it, and the women said okay, and the women have done it and are outperforming in every area of life. In any area the women have gone into, they are achieving better than men in any area except areas that require physical strength, and the men have there's an unbelievable degradation, deterioration of the male, and America leads the way. And clearly that must be impacting on singles and homosexuality, and also now the men can't find women, so they find other ways that they can possess. They can't possess a woman, so now you can possess a man, because there's been a role reversal in any case.
He's gone down 3 generations to his father from the previous generation.
You can blame it on all sorts of things, and it might be right, it might be wrong. At the end of the day, a man has to, whoever's responsible for it, he has to be able to look within himself and make the changes within himself. I think society encourages it. I think that literature encourages it, that art encourages it. I think that all sorts of things encourage it. But at the end of the day, a man has himself to take care of and develop. And this aspect of the competitiveness of possession being an important part of male development, we learn in Sukkos. And we learn it, the shiur I gave on Monday night, it's part of Torah. The Torah is competitive. The Torah is the only place that competition is encouraged. Kinas Sofrim, we call it, the encouraged jealousy of scholars of one another to compete, to battle, to dominate, to master, to argue. You'll go into a yeshiva, you'll find chavrusas, it's like a sports field. when you go into a yeshiva based on medrash, it's not a quiet library. That's how it is in a real yeshiva. It's not something which is quiet. It's in that environment that the man is meant to develop his capacity to argue, to concede if he's wrong, but to fight his point through if he's right, and convince people and swing people. That's part of the competitive nature of Torah learning. So Torah is not a feminine activity. That's why we discussed on Monday night. It's not part of the being. Torah is part of the having. Torah is part of mastery and domination. As is marriage, as is business, as is lulav, as opposed to sukkah, which is the more feminine of the mitzvahs.
But isn't marriage about having a joint vision? I mean, it's not a matter, is it, of a male dictating that this is the vision I have for my life and you are an extension of me. That to me is, I mean, you'll find women like that who are totally enamored of their husbands and whatever they do is right, and they feel good about it, and, you know, very easy for the male because he's got a woman who's going to go along with whatever he does. But to introduce an ongoing sense of dynamism in your marriage seems to me suggests the potential for growth, and grow together in developing the vision that you have. I understand the notion that if you've got a competitive relationship, that you're going, your vision now is separate. But I don't see marriage about, you know, my husband has a vision, and that's
no, absolutely not. You'll have that in the coming together stage. In other words, if a man says, my vision is A, B, and C, and she says on their first date, that's a silly vision. And he says, you're right, what vision do you think I should have? And she says, X, Y, and Z. And he says, well, how about compromising on F or G or somewhere in the middle? And she says, well, okay, I can live with that. And now they have a vision, dead. He's got to have a vision that she says, great, and then during the course of their marriage, that grows and expands, and she brings all sorts of things onto it. So the dynamic process thereon, yes, but she'd better be careful that she doesn't hijack it in that process. But again, so if she is very bright and she is very dynamic, it's a matter of her expanding his vision, and that's what he needs her for. That's why there's an Ezer, that's why there's that, that's why he needs that possession. And again, one mustn't think of possession in a small sense, one has to think of possession in a very large and a very universal sense. He needs that possession because she can bring not only to the implementation of his vision, but to the expansion of his vision. But it has to be something that they both participate in the growth of, but something she identified with at the outset, not something she persuaded him into as they went along. And at some point in the marriage, he wakes up and realizes, this was never really my vision. Okay, so that ties the...
Maybe can. So then, I don't get it. Then why are we not supposed to be, or we're not obligated to sit in the sukkah and because of,
well,
the vision,
sitting in
his vision?
No, because the lulav and esrog, because you can't shake a lulav and esrog, you are a lulav and esrog. But right, a woman is the role of that relationship of lulav and esrog is the role of possession, of being possessed,
okay,
therefore the synthesis.
Okay,
but what we
you're a lulav and esrog.
You have to be careful, please. Do not go to the other side of town and tell them that Rabbi Latin said that women are lulav and esrog. Women are lulav and esrog. You shake them up. You see, that's the. So the idea of ownership, of growth through ownership, is not the woman's area of growth. The woman's area of growth is growth through being owned by somebody who grows through ownership. And therefore that synthesis of sukkah and lulav and esrog doesn't apply. Sukkah does apply to her, but in what capacity? In expanding his mitzvah of sukkah. That they do it together, and by doing it together, their being is a different being. His being is a different being. She impacts on him and her and the whole family by being there for him and supportive of him. And supportive doesn't mean working for him and slaving for him. That's not the image at all. The image is each relationship where that is the most important. So for some it will be in a more material area, in some a more emotional area, in some a more intellectual area. It doesn't matter where it is. But she has to be there as a supportive partner rather than a competing an aggressive competitor. Okay, let's see.